You're listening to Asbury University's Chapel Podcast, recorded live from our campus in Wilmore, Kentucky. Asbury's Chapel Service hosts speakers from around the world to inspire academic excellence and spiritual vitality. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Our chapel frame this morning is Heart Holiness. It's about our being. It's about being a follower of Jesus. It's about our formation. It's about the habits of our heart. Heart holiness is trusting Jesus Christ for salvation and sanctification. And as we gather in worship and as we gather to be taught, we're constantly having our salvation unfold and our sanctification being worked out. This morning, we're really grateful for Dr. Felicia Song. She is a cultural sociologist who studies the place of digital technologies in contemporary life. And she holds degrees from Yale, from Northwestern, and the University of Virginia. Her research has been oriented around the rapidly evolving digital technology industry and how the adoption of social media and digital devices fundamentally alters the landscapes of family, community, and organizational life. She is the author of at least a couple of books that I'll mention. One, Restless Devices, most recently, about 15 years ago. She is the author of Virtual Communities, Bowling Alone, Online Together. And when Dr. Song is not working, she enjoys reading children's chapter books, gardening, we share that love together, and doing New York Times crosswords puzzles. And she daydreams about becoming a bass player. So let's welcome Dr. Song to Asbury this morning.
All right. Good morning, Asbury. It is really a pleasure and honor to be with you at chapel today. I want to invite you to consider how it is that despite how much we know we are people who lack patience, we are a people who hate waiting, I think we need to begin recognizing how we actually have become a people who live in waiting. We live in wait on our digital technologies. We are constantly waiting on them to deliver belonging and affirmation. But in that waiting, we are like the child that C.S. Lewis describes as wanting to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. So today I want to invite you to join me for a few minutes to perhaps set down your phones. Let us consider an offer of a holiday at the sea. And it comes in the form of a meditation that I think of in three parcels. I've kind of thought of this talk as three parcels that I'm calling the waiting. And I also think of it as a meditation. So I encourage you to focus on your breath, to consider how you're holding your body posture, and to attend the next few minutes as you breathe through this meditation. But before that, let's, if you would, pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. So, 13 years ago, I converted and invited the iPhone 4, affectionately known as the Jesus phone by Apple fans, into my life. My husband and I took the leap of faith and accepted the Jesus phone into our lives because we believed, we thought it would better manage our work and family lives. after a long stint of conscientious objection to giving over my life data to Mark Zuckerberg, I also joined Facebook in 2013 and then dumped Facebook 6 years afterwards. That's a story for another day. But through these years of digital living, I really am genuinely grateful for how my devices have helped me to fashion a life that is more convenient, more efficient, often more pleasurable. But just as the Christian faith asserts that Jesus Christ transforms anyone who opens themselves up to his presence, I can personally testify to the curious ways in which the Jesus phone has transformed me. My relationships, my work patterns, my routines of how I spend my time, what I think about, how I engage my spaces. And the more I consider how deeply the logic and the presence of my digital devices have penetrated my subconscious, the more troubled I've become. And during my early years on social media, when I was regularly experiencing the deliciously satisfying river of digital affirmation, I grew to feel like I needed to engage. I needed to post. I needed to publish in order to exist. I had come to even feel at times that my relationships were primarily cultivated in terms of transaction, reciprocity, as I liked or commented my way into trusted interdependence with others. And so I felt this imperative to keep up, to grasp for attention, to curate my life in order that it could be broadcast. And it all felt so normal. And so too was this expectation to live in a state of permanent connectivity. And what I mean by permanent connectivity is that even when our devices are not in our hands or within sight, our consciousness has become thoroughly trained and immersed in the habits of mind, formed by an unceasing awareness of how our life is constantly lived elsewhere. Our bodies are in one place, but our collective consciousness understands that increasingly, no matter where we are, what we're doing, a core piece of our being is actually bent towards what's happening somewhere else, online. The statistics are sobering. 48% of Americans, this is age 18 to 29, reported that they are almost constantly online. Studies show that the majority of our time spent online goes by with very little reflection because it's an accumulation of micro moments in between classes, in between activities, waiting online. And the digital practices that characterize our lives are largely habitual, compulsive. We don't even realize why we're looking at our screens. It's just, I'm just looking. And when we consider how the digital media industries are invested in securing, even colonizing our attention and searching for new and efficient ways to monetize our most basic human needs for relationship and belonging, it's not surprising that the act of turning to our screens has basically become synonymous with what it means to be connected and what it means to belong. And it's in this way that I think it's apt to borrow the biblical notion of abiding to describe our relationship with the digital today, right? So Jesus called his disciples to abide in him as he would abide in them. But I think we too have become a people who actually abide in the digital. And the digital abides in us. And so herein lies the problem. Many of us claim to adhere to a Christian faith that calls us to shed our masks, to admit to our failures, and to cease comparing ourselves to others. But we are almost constantly online, connected to an attention economy and a digital ecology that is relentlessly training us to perform, to hide our weaknesses, and to compete against each other for attention. Please know I have no interest or intention in shaming you into getting off of your phones or social media. I think many of us stew in plenty of guilt about our digital habits. I'm naming the problem because it is part of my own confession. I feel the struggle deeply in myself as well. I feel the sense that something's not quite right, but I often find myself incapable of living the life I know I ought to be living. We are like the sick, the blind, and the paralyzed, waiting at the pool of Bethesda, described in John 5. The healing waters are stirring, and Jesus is gently asking us, "My dear one, do you want to be made well?" Parcel number two. In her book, The Human Condition, Hannah Arendt comments on a reporter's characterization of the first successful satellite launch as a first, quote, step towards the escape from men's imprisonment to the earth. And Arendt regarded this great technological achievement as one in a long line of technologies driven by a wish to escape the human condition. Now, Arendt was writing back in 1958. I think her comment is still meaningful today. When we look at our digital landscape, we can see our attempts to escape the human condition. When we consider the plethora of digital options, how they promise to liberate us from the uncertainties and inconveniences and constraints that come with the limitations of our physical bodies being embedded in a given place and a given time. We are ever seeking to calm our fears and enhance our control when we wrap ourselves in blankets of unending news and social media updates. We keep ourselves warm with the comfort of knowledge. And some of us race to the carnival of social media, streaming, entertainment, online retail, and promise to reduce the distance we might feel from each other and offer new solutions to loneliness and alienation, these problems that the philosophers, artists, and theologians have long pondered through the ages. And indeed, often it seems we turn to the digital seeking refuge from the harsh realities of our world. And during these past heartbreaking years of pandemic, racial violence, political division, if we look around at the fractured condition of our nation, the church, family, perhaps college, even in ourselves, it's understandable that we would want to escape. So many of us carry the fresh wounds in need of healing. And with the possible prospect of things still needing to get worse before they get better, what do we do? Well, we run into the beckoning arms of the digital and social media. It's addictive, in part because it dulls the pain. Pascal once wrote, "Being unable to cure death, wretchedness, and ignorance, we have decided in order to be happy not to think about such things." And to know that even Pascal, living in the 17th century, had observed our human instinct to run away from the helpless disappointment of what being human often is, I find strangely comforting. It helps me remember that we aren't the only ones who have had to struggle against the problems of misery and brutality. But I think what's different today is that the digital is really effective at helping us not to think about such things. The digital realm is a hyped-up version of reality, tricked out with filters that make it impossible to ignore. Jean Baudrillard calls this the hyper-real. It is glamorous, it is alluring. It is the product of well-researched strategies, employing both behavioral psychology and neuroscience to keep us hooked. It's no wonder that we can't pull ourselves away from our screens. We want to slip away into the digital and to escape. And in this way, I think our technologies are encouraging us to be a people who are living on the run. We tell ourselves that we're running in order to keep up. But I think more often, we're actually running away. We're running from the pain of being human. We are running from the possibility that sometimes there's just no way out, but only through. And I think the good news of Christianity is that it's actually a religion about going through. Unlike what many presume, it's not a religion that offers a formula of escape through good works or sacrifice. Instead, it's a promise of the presence of God who is ready to go through with us. In the incarnation of Jesus, we see how our Lord chose to experience all the indignities of being human through poverty, through ethnic marginalization, through political oppression, experiencing the frustrations of injustice. And I think in this Lenten season, we are called to contemplate how it is that Jesus allowed himself to be subjected to human suffering of the worst kind on our behalf, in solidarity with us. And it is this good news that it is this God, right, this God who dwells in solidarity, who went through death and undid its power through the resurrection. It's this God who goes through with us when we are in the ashes. And at the heart of Christianity is the steadfast promise that God's very presence is what gives us hope and empowers us to go through the worst that life can bring. Theologian Jürgen Moltmann wrote this quote. It's a little long, so I have it up here. The ultimate reason for our hope is not to be found at all in what we want, wish for, and wait for. The ultimate reason is that we are wanted and wished for and waited for. What is it that awaits us? Does anything await us at all? Or are we alone? Whenever we base our hope on trust in the divine mystery, we feel deep down in our heart, there is someone who is waiting for you, who is hoping for you, who believes in you. God is our last hope because we are God's first love. Okay, parcel number three. So while talk of Christ's incarnation and God's presence are lovely sentiments, often when we hear them, we have no clue how to genuinely step into these realities. We hear these familiar passages, like Jesus' invitation to the disciples that I alluded to before, abide in me as I abide in you. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. We hear these words, but honestly, don't we struggle for genuine understanding of what it means to abide in Jesus and to be present to him? This question of abiding seems particularly difficult to grasp when our digital defaults have left us untrained in being fully present to anyone these days, never mind being fully present to the Lord. More often than not, our attention is scattered by the many demands placed upon us, the varied needs of others, the pleasures and obligations of social media and the digital. And as I suggested earlier, if we know anything about abiding, the one thing we seem to know is how to abide in the presence of our devices. We all know that the degree of attention we reserve for our digital devices and their notifications is incomparable to what fragmented attention we give to each other and what fragmented attention we give to God. Indeed, even though the constant checking of our devices is an impoverished form of abiding, I want to suggest today that we might learn something, actually, from these distorted habits. about how we are to actually prize the abiding or remaining in Jesus. So rather than feeling bad about how we attend to our devices more than we might attend to the presence of Christ, I think there's a spiritual truth here we can learn. Right? The more instructive parallel we need to draw is in the heart of expectancy that many of us have come to cultivate in our posture of permanent connectivity towards our digital lives. Right? As I mentioned before, many of us already live in a state of waiting, anticipating, sensing that there is something asking for our attention. We live in a state of waiting for that word from someone, anyone, in fact, through our digital devices. Whether we wait in fear, or we wait in missing out, or we wait in a state of dull hunger, seeking to be stimulated, we go through our days accustomed to having our bodies in one place and our minds elsewhere. And our hearts are attuned, finely tuned, to our devices in the same way like any of those Jane Austen characters, right? Those disadvantaged maidens that are waiting in the parlor for their suitor to visit, right? Some of you may be familiar with those characters, right? We're like those maidens, except when the notification pings, it's as if we hear the digital footsteps approaching, and rather than having one's desperation bridled by a Victorian code of refined decorum, no, we're not like that. We reflexively leap with our fingers to tap on our screens to ravenously devour whatever, whoever, anything that comes through the door. And indeed, what we have discovered in our digitally saturated society is that we actually have a remarkable endurance. We have an incredible capacity to remain in tune with our devices. It is the first thing we greet in the morning, often the last thing we look at before we go to bed. We tend to our devices in between meetings and activities at any pause in our life. We are very diligent. It's always on our minds, it's always in our hearts. Why? Because we are waiting, we're searching for joy, for purpose, for satisfaction, for love. We are waiting, and therefore we are abiding in the digital. So what if we were to cultivate that same heart of expectancy for God's desire to speak to us, to commune with us? What if our antenna was stretched out to checking in with God as much as we are always compulsively checking in on our devices? Even more, what if we were filled with an expectancy that there is a word for us, right, for me, that I could trust that word, that that word wouldn't be simply asking something from me, that that word was coming to nourish me? What if I knew that there was a word that revealed God's very nature waiting just for me? And that God's nature was defined by a crazy, faithful love that actually likes who I am, likes my company, and even takes delight in me? What if I was waiting on a love that grants me the permission to be fully myself, fearless, because I know I am loved, and that I'm not condemned, and that I'm not pegged as a sad sack failure or disappointment? This is what it is to hear from God, and this is in part what it means to be saved. Saved from the crushing weight of the world's despair, saved from our own self-destructive tendencies, saved not by being enveloped by our digital blankets, but wrapped up securely in God's gentle and loving presence. This is the heart of expectancy we are invited to enter into during Lent, when we are called to self-examination, and we're called to wade through the days of Holy Week, having to confront in remembrance the horrors of what human beings can do to each other, even what we're willing to do to the one we call Lord and Messiah, before we can get to the hope of resurrection. When the voice of Jesus calls us by name, and we are awakened and invited to taste new life and new hope. So in closing, let us return to Moltmann's word. I'm going to have the beginning of his quote up here, but I invite you to close your eyes as I read the fullness of this quote as the gospel choir returns. The ultimate reason for our hope is not to be found at all in what we want, wish for, and wait for. The ultimate reason is that we are wanted and wished for and waited for. What is it that awaits us? Does anything await us at all? Or are we alone? Whenever we base our hope on trust in the divine mystery, we feel deep down in our hearts, there is someone who is waiting for you, who is hoping for you, who believes in you. God is our last hope because we are God's first love. Amen.